Welcome to I Think Therefore iPod, a podcast on all things Apple and beyond. March 11th, 2006. Hi everybody and welcome to the show. Today I'm going to be talking about three things. First of all, I'm going to talk about my trip to the Apple Store, where I got a chance to test drive the new iPod Hi-Fi, as well as a couple of other things. Then I'm going to talk briefly about browsers in OS X, and attempt to tackle the age-old question of which browser is best. And finally, I'll be discussing a couple of topics on maintaining and optimizing your system. So, let's get started. Well, I had the pleasure of going to the Apple Store yesterday to test out the new iPod Hi-Fi. And it's worth remembering that this product got a lot of stick when it was first released, partly because I think that there was so much hype over the Apple event where it was unveiled that its release seemed almost anticlimactic because, I mean, it's not the most spectacular product that Apple's ever released. But now that a lot of that media hype and initial disappointments dissipated, I think we can go and take a look at this product as it is to see whether or not it's actually worth buying. So here's my own little review of the iPod Hi-Fi after having a chance to play with it for a while. First of all, let's look at its design and its build. Well, it's basically a big black and white box, and one thing I found was that it looks much nicer in real life than it does in photographs. Because when I first saw the photographs of the iPod Hi-Fi, I thought, what is that? It looked like a little microwave or something. But when I actually got a chance to look at it and touch it in person, I actually thought that it looked pretty sweet. Its simplicity and elegance of design was typical Apple, and I found it really attractive. It's definitely something I wouldn't mind having on my own desk. In terms of size, I found it to be about the size of a small printer, so you could easily put this on a desk or on a shelf or on your floor. And the only cable attached to it was the power cable, and the internal power box is inside the unit, which is something that I really like, because with the speakers I use right now, which are JBL Creature speakers, well, first of all, they're not iPod speakers, they're my computer speakers. But second of all, they have the big black power box, and I have to find a place to put that all the time, and it's really ugly. So it's really nice to have this inside the system. The batteries fit right into the back, there are no obstructive parts. In fact, the only thing that really sticks out of the iPod Hi-Fi is, well, your iPod. There are only two buttons on the front, which are volume control. And the thing comes with the Apple remote, which worked seamlessly with it. Which is a big plus, because it's a lot nicer to be able to control your music with a remote control than having to go up and fiddle with your iPod every single time you want to change a track or something. The bottom of the iPod Hi-Fi is made of the same material as the bottom of an iPod dock, which means that when you put it on a surface, it's going to stay there and it's not going to move around. And that material has iPod written on it in really large letters, which is great to look at. The front of the unit, where the speakers are, has a grill that's attached to it, and this grill comes off easily. It's attached by four pins that you push into little slots. I must say that I thought the iPod Hi-Fi looked so nice without the grill on, but I wouldn't recommend this because the grill is there to protect the actual speaker components, and it doesn't distort the sound when it's on. And the final thing about its design and its build to talk about would be its weight. Now, at 17 pounds with the batteries in it, the iPod Hi-Fi isn't the lightest unit on the planet, but I found that picking it up was not a problem at all, so this thing can definitely be moved around, and its one-piece design is perfect for this. It's excellent for portability, unlike some of the multi-piece speaker systems out there or the giant hi-fis that people have in their living rooms. I could definitely see myself carrying the iPod Hi-Fi outdoors or to another room and have my music play from somewhere else. So what about sound quality? Well, first of all, in terms of volume, this thing is impressive for its size. It had no problem filling up the entire Apple Store with sound. And the great thing was that at very high volumes, there's actually very little distortion on the iPod Hi-Fi. The iPod Hi-Fi has very strong and very impressive bass, and its treble and mid-tones weren't bad at all. So overall, the sound quality was very impressive, especially with the low distortion levels at high volumes. But whilst the overall sound quality of the iPod Hi-Fi is very good and very impressive, I wouldn't quite call it phenomenal, in that it won't wow the most hardcore of audiophiles in the same way that some hi-fi systems can. But I think most average consumers will be very impressed and very happy with the sound quality that this machine delivers. The thing is, at the end of the day, These are iPod speakers. And the question I have is, who really encodes their MP3s that they keep on their iPods at the highest possible bit rates? My point being that even if the iPod Hi-Fi were capable of producing near-perfect sound quality, the MP3s that we keep on our iPods in general won't be able to reproduce such quality because they won't be encoded at a high enough bit rate. But at the end of the day, when it comes down to iPod docking speakers, the iPod Hi-Fi definitely has much better sound quality than a lot of the other alternatives out there, which also tend to be much smaller, mind you. So, what about pricing? Is the iPod Hi-Fi value for money? Well, it's about the price of an iPod, so some people initially have reservations about paying the same amount or more for an accessory than the item that they're trying to accessorize. But I think that if you buy an iPod Hi-Fi, it'll change the way that you use your iPods. Because one thing I find is that when I'm not out, my iPods just sit around in my room, and I play my music on my computer through my JBL Creature 2 speakers over AirTunes. But the iPod Hi-Fi would give iPods a completely new dimension of use. You could bring it outside, move it to different parts of the room, and it could be used to provide completely different effects. For example, you could put it in the bottom corner of a room and play classical music to provide a nice ambiance, or you could put it somewhere noticeable and blast loud music. And with the bass that this thing is capable of producing, that could be really nice. But if we're talking about value for money, it's probably worth comparing the iPod Hi-Fi to some of the alternatives out there. So first of all, let's compare it to some of the other iPod speakers out there. And if you haven't seen any of these before, companies like JBL and Altec Lansing produce a lot of them. And basically what they are speaker sets where you plug your iPod into them, turn them on, and they play your music. Now, the iPod Hi-Fi is, in general, a lot pricier than these kinds of iPod speakers. But one thing to bear in mind is that the iPod Hi-Fi also produces much better sound quality. Its bass is far stronger than any of the plug-and-play alternatives I've seen out there. And on top of that, it's a lot louder, and its overall sound quality just beats any of these alternative systems into the ground. But the iPod Hi-Fi claims to be a hi-fi system, not an iPod docking speaker set. So let's compare it to some of those. Well, first of all, it's a lot cheaper than expensive hi-fi systems, many of which can cost thousands of dollars. But it's not quite up there in terms of sound quality yet. Now, the thing is, with a really good hi-fi system, when you listen to a band or an orchestra playing, you should be able to pick out the area in space where each individual instrument is playing. It's an overall audio experience that these hi-fi systems give. Now, the iPod Hi-Fi doesn't quite give you that, partly because it's one set of speakers, so you can't place different speaker components in different parts of the room as you might do with a full Hi-Fi system. But on top of that, its overall sound quality just isn't up to the standard that some of these high-end Hi-Fi systems can produce. But at the end of the day, it also costs a heck of a lot less than these systems, so it's probably good value for money in that sense. And ultimately, the iPod Hi-Fi sound quality is probably more than good enough for your average consumer, who won't be anywhere near as picky as your hardcore audiophile. So overall, the iPod Hi-Fi was touted as a replacement for expensive home Hi-Fi systems, and indeed, those systems do cost a heck of a lot more than this iPod Hi-Fi. And I think that for average consumers, its volume and its sound quality could very well make it a very apt replacement for hi-fi systems and save you a lot of money in the process. But it still won't compete with the top hi-fi systems in terms of providing the ultimate audio experience. But I do think that the iPod Hi-Fi would be perfect for certain situations, for the dorm room, for example, or for filling your apartment or your house with music for the average non-audiophile listener. And I think that the iPod Hi-Fi would almost certainly be able to handle a small to medium-sized party because it's just that loud and it sounds that good. And in the market of plug-and-play iPod speakers, this is probably by far the best-sounding one as well, even though it does cost a bit more. So I think that what we can take out of all of this is that, on balance, the iPod Hi-Fi is much better than most of the other iPod-specific speaker sets out there, in terms of sound quality, but it's also a lot more expensive. But at the same time, compared to the top-end hi-fi systems, it can't compete with them in terms of sound quality, but it's also much, much, much cheaper. So, my final verdict on the iPod Hi-Fi? Well, I see it as more of a very, very high quality boombox than a small and compact hi-fi system. But overall, I think it's very good value for money compared to other alternatives out there, and it's definitely something that I would consider buying. And the final question I had about the iPod Hi-Fi is, what does this mean for competition? Now that Apple is encroaching upon a part of the market that's always been dominated by third-party companies, will these competitors get angry? And I think perhaps they will, but it's much more likely that the likes of JBL and Altec Lansing will feel threatened by the iPod Hi-Fi than, say, the companies that make the big high-end hi-fi systems. But at the end of the day, I think that one could argue that the iPod Hi-Fi caters to a slightly different market than the producers of these small iPod speakers, because these small iPod speakers are cheaper and of lower quality, and so they're for portability or convenience. You won't use them to fill your house with rich sound, whereas the iPod Hi-Fi is probably capable of doing this in most situations. Now, no trip to the Apple store would be complete without playing with some of the Macintosh systems on display. And the first thing I noticed when I got there was that they had MacBook Pros. And I've never actually gotten my hands on one of these ones, so I jumped at the opportunity. They actually had four of them on display, which is more than a lot of Apple stores have. But I actually had to line up before I could use one. That's how popular these things were. And the MacBook Pro is absolutely beautiful. It looks just like the 15-inch PowerBook. It's thin, and it has MacBook Pro printed on it in shiny letters. It's really, really pretty to behold. Now, the first thing I went to play with was the MagSafe connector, which of course is the new magnetic power cable for the MacBook Pro, which just comes off if you trip over the cable or if you pull on it. It struck me that it was a lot smaller than I thought it would be. When I initially saw the pictures of the MagSafe connector, I thought that the plug looked quite big. But actually, it's really small. It's smaller than a FireWire plug, for example. And I tested it out naturally, and it holds firmly in place, but it works beautifully if you tug on it. The plug just comes straight off. I must say that I really love this new innovation, because I can't begin to tell you the number of power adapters, or laptops even, that I've broken by tripping over the power cable. The built-in eyesight is far too cool. Naturally, I played with it using Photo Booth, and it's just as good, if not better, than the iSight camera that I own, so I really like that feature. Front Row, of course, works on the MacBook Pro, complete with Apple Remote and all, and it ran without any problems, and movies just looked so good on the display of the MacBook Pro, because the resolution and brightness of these screens is just wonderful to behold. A little subtle change on the MacBook Pro is that the trackpad is a lot larger than the trackpad on the PowerBook or the iBook, and I actually found that this really makes quite a difference in using the system. I found doing things like the two-finger scroll, which already works so beautifully on the previous PowerBooks and iBooks, it just makes it easier and nicer to use. Performance-wise, I was also very impressed by the MacBook Pro. I ran iPhoto, and they had already loaded a couple thousand images onto it, and it ran really smoothly. I zoomed out so that iPhoto would show the highest number of thumbnails on each screen, and then I just scrolled between the photos, and it scrolled seamlessly. As Steve Jobs put it so beautifully, it scrolls like butter. One thing that I would have liked would be to have tested some non-universal apps like Photoshop, but unfortunately none of these were installed on the MacBook Pro, so I didn't get a chance to see Rosetta in action on these systems. When I was finally done playing with the MacBook Pro, I headed on over to the PowerMac G5s. And what this Apple store had done was that they had set up a PowerMac G5, a quad-core, I think, complete with a 30-inch Apple Cinema display, Mighty Mouse and keyboard, as well as a musician's keyboard attached. First and foremost, the 30-inch display was absolutely breathtaking, and I just felt powerful just to be using the system. So what I did was, I went on to run Aperture and Final Cut Pro simultaneously. Now, I didn't get to spend as much time with these applications as I would have liked, but my initial impressions were very positive, to put it lightly, both with the machine and with the software. The fact that one could run Aperture and Final Cut Pro simultaneously just speaks volumes about how powerful the Power Mac G5 is, bearing in mind that King Kong was edited on Final Cut Pro. Aperture impressed me a lot. It handled raw images very well, which is really, really impressive. The images and the histograms loaded very quickly, and it had a typical Apple user-friendly interface, but the interface was really powerful too. So one could do all the things that a professional photographer would need to do. And as I was messing around with Aperture, I just ran Final Cut Pro in the background. I loaded up a movie and played with it at the end. But to be honest, I really don't know how to use Final Cut Pro. I mean, I don't edit movies like King Kong. But wow, what a machine. Alright, let's talk about web browsers now. And what I'm going to do now is just attempt to tackle the question of which browser is the best browser for OS X. And I think at the end of the day, it comes down to a choice between three. Those three would be Safari, Camino, and Firefox. Now, a couple others like Opera, Internet Explorer, and Netscape merit a mention perhaps, but none of them come anywhere close to the quality that Safari, Camino, and Firefox offer. So let's look at Safari first of all. Well, Safari obviously is Apple's default browser, and as such it has that familiar Apple look and feel. And overall it's very snappy to use, it feels nice, and it has a lot of cool features like page snapback. And one thing that I particularly like about Safari is that it does RSS very well. Now, I love my RSS bookmarks, which stands for Really Simple Syndicate, by the way. And what they are basically are bookmarks that automatically show you when the website bookmarked updates itself. And the way Safari does RSS with the blue banner on top and every article beneath, it's nice to look at on the one hand, but the thing I really like about it is the fact that it has a spotlight-esque search field in the top right-hand corner, making it really easy to find the post or the article that you're looking for. Of course, since Safari was made by Apple, it integrates seamlessly with the rest of your Apple applications. You can mail web pages easily through Apple's mail. And one thing I find is that if you use all of Apple's software, they integrate so well with each other that it's always better to use Apple software as opposed to third-party alternatives. But that's not to say that Safari is without disadvantages. First of all, it doesn't officially support any add-ons, although third-party add-ons like Safari Stand do exist, which is one that I use, by the way, to enhance my browsing experience. But on top of that, it doesn't support certain standard features and web templates. The most noticeable for me would be Blogger's Composer. Of course, there are also the Safari security issues that we've been made aware of in recent weeks, but honestly, Apple has patched these. My main gripe with Safari is that, first of all, it crashes occasionally, but on top of that, it has some really odd compatibility issues. Microsoft's website is probably the most noticeable one. It seems to hate Safari. The Vista site and the website for the new Ultra mobile PCs just don't work with Safari, but they work without any problems on Camino, for example. But I think this could be deliberate anti-Apple discrimination on Microsoft's part. Now, before I go on to talk about any of the other browsers, it's worth noting that any browser has an initial disadvantage over Safari. First of all, because Safari is such a good browser that there's very little reason for your average Mac user to want to switch to another browser. But on top of that, it can be a bit of a pain to import your settings and your bookmarks and everything else into a new browser. Now, whilst I'm aware that you can do this with one click, my gripe with this is that RSS bookmarks don't get imported properly when you import your bookmarks. Instead, what happens is, if you import your bookmarks from Safari into, say, Camino or Firefox, and you try to click on your RSS bookmarks, what they try to do is launch Safari. So you basically have to rebuild all of these bookmarks from scratch. So really, your average Mac user won't ever need any other browser other than Safari. But that's not going to stop me from taking a look at some of the other ones. Now, one browser whose stock has been rapidly rising in my book is Camino. And it's very much like Safari in a lot of ways. It does have a couple of advantages over it. First of all, it feels slightly snappier than Safari. And I actually think that, in general, it's a faster browser. It has a simple and elegant interface that you can customize, just like Safari. And as they say, it combines Mozilla power with the Aqua feel. Camino also fully supports web templates that Safari doesn't, the most noticeable one being, of course, Blogger's Composer in my case. And I actually find myself using Camino more and more frequently to create the posts on my website. But Camino doesn't seem quite as sleek as Safari. It doesn't have the same Aqua and Apple user interface and look and feel that Safari has. So Safari just feels more enjoyable to use overall. And of course, Camino doesn't integrate with Apple software quite as well as Safari does, and I don't think any third-party application will ever do that. But Camino's still being developed and is constantly being updated, so it's definitely one to watch. The final browser to mention here would be Firefox. And Firefox is just a great browser. It's fast, it's simple, it supports loads and loads of different add-ons. And I can completely understand why Firefox is quickly becoming one of the most popular browsers on the PC platform. It was just clearly designed with the ultimate user experience in mind. But Firefox doesn't quite do it for me on the Macintosh. First of all, it feels a little bit too much like a PC application. So that's a disadvantage in the sense that it doesn't have the look and feel of an Apple application that Safari and Camino have. And on top of that, I really don't like the way that Firefox does RSS. The way it does it is that when you have an RSS bookmark and you click on it, instead of getting the RSS feed page, you get a pop-up menu with all of the previous posts listed. And I just prefer the way that Safari and Camino to an extent handle RSS compared to Firefox. And given the extent to which I use RSS bookmarks and RSS feeds, this really is an important factor when it comes to selecting which browsers I want to use. So overall, Safari is still the browser for me, and it's probably going to require something very spectacular or innovative to drive me away from using Safari as my primary browser. Now, whilst the title of Best OS X Browser is probably a battle between Safari, Camino, or Firefox, there are a couple of others that are worth mentioning. First of all, there's Opera, which is a nice browser. It does tabbed browsing well, and it has a really nice way of logging into sites on which you've saved your passwords. It has this little magic wand that you can click on when you visit these sites, and it'll just log you in automatically. But Opera feels really buggy and unstable when I use it. It crashes on me a lot, and it's really not as fast as any of the other alternatives, especially in startup. I find that Opera takes a lot longer to load than any of the other alternatives I've tried. So whilst it's a nice web browser, I don't see myself using Opera anytime soon on a regular basis. Then of course there's Internet Explorer, made by our good friends at Microsoft, which I still think is the number one browser on the PC platform. Well, Microsoft has actually dropped support for Internet Explorer on Macs, so don't expect there to be any updates for it. But honestly, that doesn't really make a difference. I don't know many Mac users who care about Internet Explorer. It has a cumbersome interface, it's not intuitive to use, and nowhere near as fast as Safari, and it just gives me a frustrating overall user experience, much like the case with a lot of Microsoft software, actually. So needless to say, I really don't like this browser. And the final browser to mention is the other big name browser, and that would be Netscape. And this is quite possibly the worst of the lot. Netscape is so slow, it has such a cumbersome and ugly interface, and there's so much useless stuff on it that I never find myself using. I can't even begin to comprehend why anybody would want to use this browser. So that's my take on the good, the bad, and the ugly of Mac OS X browsers, and I think that ultimately Safari still takes the trophy. But this isn't the most interesting subject in the world, so let's not dwell on it any further. The final thing I want to talk about today is a little bit on optimizing and maintaining your system. Now, Mac OS X optimizes itself. What it does is it runs Unix maintenance scripts in the dark hours of the night, between 3 a.m. and 5 a.m. roughly. So if you leave your computer on at night, your Mac will maintain itself. So what this means is that usually, There is very little that a Mac user needs to do in terms of maintaining and optimizing one system. We don't have to deal with the same kind of viruses, malware, spyware, running disk defragmentation or running scan disk, and all of that other stuff that PC users have to deal with on a daily basis. But that doesn't mean that there's nothing for a Mac user to do in terms of optimization and maintenance of one system. And the main reasons that I would do things to optimize and maintain my system would be to ensure snappier performance and to avoid the spinning beach ball of death. So there are a couple of tips that I would recommend for all Mac users. First of all, leave your computer on at night from time to time so that it can run those maintenance scripts that I mentioned earlier. Well, if you know Unix, you can actually change the times that these scripts run, or you can run them manually from the terminal. And for the record, OS X runs a daily, a weekly, and a monthly script automatically. The one third-party tool that I think no Mac should be without is a little piece of software called Onyx. And what this does is it allows you to do all the necessary maintenance you'll ever really need to do to your computer. And that includes running the OS X maintenance scripts, repairing and verifying permissions, optimizing your system, and all sorts of other stuff. So if you don't have Onyx on your OS X system, I really recommend that you go and download it, and I'll be sure to provide a link for it on my website. Another thing you can do is shut your computer down from time to time. Don't leave it on all the time. And I find that if I leave my computer on for too long, it starts behaving a little bit sluggishly, and I see the beach ball of death a little bit more frequently than I would like. So what I do in response to this is to shut down my computer and let it reboot. And after I do this, it always seems fresher. I'm not entirely sure if this actually does anything, or if it does, why this might be the case. But it seems to work for me, so turn your computer off and let it rest every once in a while. And finally, it helps to make sure that everything's going well. So run disk utility from time to time just to verify your disks. Run the activity monitor to see how much free RAM and CPU you have, and also to see if any applications or tasks are unnecessarily hogging your system's memory. Basically, just be aware of what your system's doing. So that's basically all I do in terms of maintaining and optimizing my system. Now, I do have two other applications that help with this, and I'll just give you my thoughts on those. The first is iDefrag. And there's actually been a lot of debate over whether or not Macs need defragmentation. And in general, the answer to this question is no, because OS X maintains itself. But I think with a huge hard drive, and if you download a lot of stuff, defragmenting might help from time to time. So I run iDefrag every once in a while, but to be honest, I don't notice any improvement in my system performance after I run it. So I do question its usefulness. And of course, there are people who say that you should not defragment a Macintosh system simply because it maintains itself, and that defragmenting your system actually does more harm to it than good. The other piece of software I have on my system is Spring Cleaning. And to be honest, this piece of software is really useless. First of all, it's very slow. For example, if I use it to try and uninstall stuff, it takes ages to conduct a search for linked and relevant files for deleting. And it also chooses the wrong stuff to delete. Sometimes it gives you things that you want to keep, and sometimes it even picks out important system files that are linked to an application. For example, I tried to uninstall Opera using Spring Cleaning, and it searched for almost 2 hours. And in the final search results, it displayed Opera, the application, which is what I had to specify in the first place. And it also listed every HTML file on my computer. And on top of that, it missed the Opera preferences that were installed along with the browser. So I just quit Spring Cleaning and deleted Opera manually. So overall, there's really very little you have to do on your Mac in terms of optimizing your system. And a lot of the third-party software out there really doesn't do much. Now, of course, there are lots of other tips and ways of maintaining and optimizing your Mac to ensure that it runs as smoothly as possible. But I've talked about what I do. If any of you out there have anything that you do that you think might be worth a note, send me an email or make a comment on my website. So that's just about it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at ithinkthereforeipodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to visit my website at ithinkthereforeipod.blogspot.com. See you next time!